Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I'll be reading are from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. All of them were published in March of 2024. Here's a sampling of what I'll be reading today. Social media is not what killed the web. Russia's tragedy, Putin's humiliation. We're all just fodder. And why Trump won't stop suing the media and losing. And hopefully we'll have time for another article or two. I hope you enjoy the program today. We'll begin with this article titled, Social Media is Not What Killed the Web. Better Browsers Made Things Worse, by Ian Bogost. Was the internet really this bad? I wondered to myself as I read the September 1995 issue of The Atlantic. I was reading the issue in digital form, displayed on Netscape's Navigator 3 on a mid-90s Macintosh, or at least on a software version of the browser and Mac provided on the website oldweb.today. The site houses an emulator that connects to the Internet Archive's record of websites, providing a full computing experience of the World Wide Web of three decades ago. That experience was the badness I was pondering, not the magazine itself, which began publishing online with this issue, whose cover story asked how Lincoln might have dealt with abortion, but the way I was reading it. The article page looked awful. The nameplate was strangely positioned, and the text was hard to read. Resizing the browser window fixed the layout, but my eyes and brain still struggled to process the words. I was alive and online that fall 29 years ago, but in my memory the web was magical, like a portal into a new way of life. Not a clunky mess like this. Now, having had the chance to travel back in time, I wonder if the clunkiness wasn't in its way a midwife to that wonder. Sometime in late 1994, a friend of mine opened a program called Mosaic in the basement computer lab at the university library. "You've got to see this," he said, as he started typing in akebono.stanford.edu. A gray page loaded with Yahoo printed at the top of a bullet list of blue links. Nothing special, but I was impressed. The World Wide Web was still new, and finding anything of use was difficult. This new, playfully named website offered a directory of sites by category: computers, politics, entertainment, and so forth. Now, using the old web emulator, I'd been transported back into this era, 1995 to 1996. I didn't know where to go on the web back then. Google wouldn't arrive for another few years, so I returned to primeval Yahoo for help. Poking through this directory anew, I visited a website on film and television careers, where I took in an interview with the prop master David Tauster. The most exciting part of his job, the pleasure of creating a vision with creative people. I visited a webzine about gender equality, illustrated with loosely rendered line-drawing figures that I recalled were a bit of an aesthetic at the time. I visited a site called webethics.com to see how the early internet thought about online dangers. The biggest one turned out to be money. Commercial websites should disclose their purpose, WebEthics said. There was a list of websites that failed to do this, called the Dirty Dozen. The top entry, a site called All Business Network, was accused of being a stealth infomercial. number 2 read, "Coming Soon," and the other 10 slots were blank. This is how the internet felt back then, promising but empty. Nobody says surfing the web anymore, but at the time the phrase made sense as a description of the lugubrious, often frustrating task of finding entertainment. A visitor online felt like a beach bum waiting to catch a wave. Channel surfing described a similar vibe one got from watching television. A lot would change in the years that followed. For one thing, much to the chagrin of the operators of WebEthics.com, the internet quickly commercialized. But even then, content, as we call it today, was rare. You might read an article or visit a brochureware website for a car or a vacuum, or even purchase a book at Amazon. What you wouldn't do was spend your whole day online. Connectivity was one reason. The library computer lab was connected via high-speed Ethernet, but home use still monopolized the phone line, as bits were eked out slowly from a modem. Wi-Fi wasn't yet widely available, and a computer was a place you had to go in the house. Using the old web emulator on my laptop, I recalled how much we used to rely on the status bar at the bottom of the window, now mostly retired, for updates on the process of loading a web page, and on the little browsing animation. Netscapes was a view of shooting stars for distraction while we waited. Online life was mostly waiting. Because every click brought more delay, one click more deliberately, browsers displayed visited links in a different color, purple by default instead of blue. They still do this, but nobody cares anymore. Using the old web browser reminded me that those purple links help you navigate a strange and arduous terrain. Yes, that's where I meant to go, or nope, already been there. Once you reached your destination, you'd be confused with a series of distractions. Screens were small back then, with low-resolution text and graphics. On the Atlantic's old website, the type was small and pixelated. Italics were not truly semi-cursive with curved letter forms, but slanted versions of Roman. Lines of text ran most of the way across the screen without a break. In order to read an entire article using Netscape in Macintosh System 7, I had to interrupt myself repeatedly to click the scroll bar button. These minor glitches may have worn away our capacity to focus, but we had no idea how much worse that problem could become. Much has been made of the way in which social media sites made internet life compulsive and all-consuming. Web search and shopping, too, have turned people's data into ads, leading them to spend ever greater quantities of time and money online. But my old web visit revealed to me that the manufacturers of computer devices and their basic software made this transformation possible. Instagram or Google would have been compelling on the old internet, but they're surely more so now. Seen on bright displays with the pixel density of a printed magazine. Before the web was good, before PCs were good, one had trouble spending hours just in Word or Excel. That may have been a blessing. It's easy to portray the websites and browsers on old web, today as primitive early steps along an evolutionary path. But at least some of what hadn't been yet figured out about the web simply wasn't worth pursuing. The World Wide Web of the 1990s was a place you went into for a little while until it spat you out. As an activity, it had an end, which came when someone needed the phone, when your eye strain overcame your interest, when the virtual ocean failed to spawn a wave worth surfing. Now, the internet goes on forever. That completes the article. The title was Social Media is Not What Killed the Web, by contributor Ian Bogost. This next article is titled Russia's Tragedy, Putin's Humiliation. Expect wild claims from supporters of the humiliated dictator, by Tom Nichols. Terrorists struck deep inside Russia on Friday, and the conspiracy theories are already spinning. Three realities. If you are trying to figure out who attacked a Russian rock concert and why they slaughtered and wounded dozens of people, your confusion is understandable. In an era when social media spews chaff and deception during every crisis, some fairly straightforward issues get obscured in all the drama. As we untangle the ghastly attack just outside of Moscow, bear in mind three realities about politics in Russia. First, some terrorist groups have a long-standing hatred of the Russians, and mass casualty attacks in Russian cities are not new. Americans, scarred by 9/11, often think that they are the prime target of Islamist extremists. But over the past two decades, Russia has endured more mass casualty terror attacks from Islamist extremists than the United States, including barbaric assaults on a school and a downtown Moscow theater. The most recent massacre is only one of a series of such attacks in Russia over the past 30 years. Second, reliable information will be scarce for some time. The immediate Russian response in such circumstances is to clamp down on the media, while government officials mostly dummy up, in part because people who may have been asleep at the switch will already be engaging in desperate ass-covering. And third, always remember that Russia and its useful idiots in the West will try to shift blames as much as possible as they try to blow the stench of failure away from Moscow. Let's start with what we know, or what we think we know, at this point. On Friday, gunmen opened fire at a crowd gathered for a concert at the Crocus City Hall, a music venue that is part of a shopping mall in the Moscow suburbs. So far, Russian authorities say at least 139 people were killed and more than 100 were wounded. The Islamic State, ISIS, has claimed responsibility, but American officials, according to the New York Times, are connecting the attack to ISIS-K. As an NPR report noted yesterday, ISIS-K is a regional group. The K stands for the Khorasan area of Central Asia that has declared its loyalty to the larger ISIS in the Middle East, and it, quote, is fighting or has declared hostilities against Al-Qaeda, China, Iran, Pakistan, Russia, Syria, the Taliban, and the United States, end quote. But it has a particular animosity for Russia. Moscow's troops have fought ISIS there in support of the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. So far, the Russian government hasn't publicly accepted the ISIS claim, but before the attack, American intelligence sources were so concerned about the possibility of an ISIS-K assault in Moscow that the State Department warned U.S. citizens to stay away from big gatherings. The Americans reached out and warned the Kremlin as well. Whether the Russian government took these warnings seriously is still unclear. The Russians have now arrested people, and four of them, all from neighboring Tajikistan, showed up in court looking like they'd been severely beaten. No surprise there, but the next development to watch for is whether they make detailed confessions. Two of them, according to the Russians, have admitted guilt. Putin, in a predictable authoritarian move, is trying to pin this attack on the Ukrainians, whose government has denied any involvement. He was just, quote, re-elected, with the Kremlin's laughable claim that he netted 87% of the vote, and his crusade against putative Ukrainian Nazis looks like lethal incompetence if Islamist terrorists can walk into Russia from next door while Russia's security agencies are focused elsewhere. He must assert that Ukrainians were involved. Otherwise, he has a lot of explaining to do about why he's butchering Orthodox Slavs in Ukraine while Russians are being butchered by Islamist terrorists in Moscow. Authoritarian governments, of course, aren't big on explaining anything to anyone, and Putin, as is his habit during a crisis, initially hunkered down and stayed silent. This is why, by the way, I don't think this was a false flag or inside job. Not that I would put it past the spooks and ghouls in the Russian intelligence services. They've done it before. But this situation is too embarrassing for Putin. If the attack were an inside job, the Kremlin would have set it up better than this incredible mess. Earlier today, Putin finally acknowledged that radical Islamists were behind the attack, and he is still trying to somehow tie them to Ukraine. The suspects will probably be required to support Putin's line, as soon as Putin settles on one, but the Russian president's attempt to pin all this on Ukraine will probably become more difficult as we learn more, including whatever the United States chooses to release about the warnings it offered to Russia. Fortunately for the Kremlin, however, Russia has apologists in the West who are already more than happy to carry forward the charge of Ukrainian involvement. The entrepreneur David Sachs, a man who almost daily illustrates the problem of plutocrats who think that their wealth qualifies them to speak about any subject, posted on X that if the Ukrainian government was behind the terrorist attack, as looks increasingly likely, the U.S. must renounce it, else we become complicit. Sachs then preemptively griped about the inevitable bogus community note that he knew was coming. On X, these community notes allow other people to correct what they believe is bad information in a post. I'm aware that Ukraine has denied responsibility for the attack. I'm also aware that such denials don't mean much. In fact, they are part of a pattern. Not as much of a pattern as Islamist extremist attacks in Russia, but for many of the Westerners siding with Russia, history began only a few years ago when Russia tried to complete its takeover of Ukraine. Sachs isn't clever enough to create really detailed nonsense. For that, we must go to the former Fox News regular and retired Colonel Douglas MacGregor, whose 2020 nomination by Donald Trump to be ambassador to Germany was stopped in the Senate. MacGregor, also posting on X, claimed that the perpetrators of the terrorist attack in Russia escaped from Russia into Ukraine, near Belgorod, and are directly tied to Muslim elements fighting on behalf of Ukraine. He added that they were allegedly paid about 500,000 rubles, of which 250,000 was paid up front. An unknown third party provided weapons. MacGregor also posted that he has, quote, little doubt that the MI6/CIA were involved. Of course, MacGregor has no way of knowing any of this, but it all sounds like a cool spy movie. It's also a matter of time before this narrative gathers steam in the right-wing ecosystem, because the charge that the terrorists escaped through Ukraine is basically Putin's line, although Putin has claimed only that this was the plan, not that any of them had made it out. It's a long way from Moscow to Belgorod. The immediate question for Ukraine and for the United States is how far Putin will go to shift the blame for this horrific tragedy away from himself and onto his various enemies. For now, the Ukrainians will bear the brunt of Putin's anger. Gangsters don't take humiliation well, and Putin will want someone to pay, even if it's just those who have the misfortune to be within his immediate reach. As always, the price will fall on ordinary Russians, Ukrainians, and potentially millions of other people who are cursed with living under, or too near, Putin's neo-fascist regime. That's the end of the article, Russia's Tragedy, Putin's Humiliation, by staff writer Tom Nichols. This next article is titled, We're All Just Fodder, What Kate Middleton Proved About the Internet, by Charlie Wazell. It was always going to end this way. The truth about Kate Middleton's absence is far less funny, whimsical, or salacious than the endless memes and conspiracy theories suggested. In a video recorded and broadcast by the BBC, the princess says she has cancer and that she has retreated from the public eye to deal with her condition while attempting to shield her children from the spotlight. Instead, she had to contend with the internet giggling about whether she'd had a Brazilian butt lift. My colleague Helen Lewis summed it up succinctly this afternoon. I hope you all feel terrible now. What is there to learn from such a sad situation? The internet is made up of people, yet its architecture abstracts this basic truth. As I wrote a few weeks ago, at the center of this months-long story was essentially a sea of people having fun online because it is unclear whether a famous person is well or not. Underneath the memes was always something a little bit gross and indefensible. Perhaps humans are just wired this way, to gawk and gossip. There's nothing new about hounding a member of the royal family or invading the privacy of a celebrity to sell tabloids or go viral. You don't even have to be a scold about it. Famous people are wealthy and beloved, at least in part, because they're fun to talk about. Exactly what we do and don't know about their internal lives is part of the allure. The discourse comes with the territory, to a degree. But Kate Middleton, of course, is a human, too. During this saga, I kept thinking about the reappraisal of Britney Spears in 2021, as well as the backlash toward past media and tabloid coverage of her rise. A New York Times documentary dredged up old coverage of Spears from the mid-aughts, showing a young woman clearly in distress, being picked apart by glossy magazines. Her suffering became entertainment. The response to this film was swift. Some of the people and institutions that had shamelessly delighted in her pain backtracked. Glamour publicly apologized to the pop star on its Instagram account, noting, "We are all to blame for what happened to Britney Spears." Contrast the Spears reckoning with the Middleton drama, and if you're being generous, you can see some of that newfound attitude in the media. I was struck by Lewis's observation that Britain's tabloid papers have shown remarkable restraint throughout this mess. Progress, perhaps, but what's also telling is that they didn't really need to do the dirty work. Random people on the internet were doing it for them. They recklessly speculated, memed, and used their amateur sleuthing and networked faux expertise to concoct elaborate, semi-plausible explanations for her absence. Was Kate's face actually photoshopped from a Vogue spread? It wasn't, but the conspiratorial tweet got 51.1 million views anyhow. Missing from much of the discourse was the idea that its main character was a person who was likely struggling. In essence, the internet democratized the tabloid experience, turning the rest of us into paparazzi and addled editors workshopping headlines and cover images, not to sell magazines, but to amass some kind of fleeting online popularity. In my least charitable moments, I see this toxic dynamic as the lasting legacy of social media, a giant metrics-infused experiment in connectivity that has had a flattering, pernicious effect. In 2021, I interviewed Ely Hunt, a journalist who'd tweeted an innocuous opinion about horror movies one evening and woke up to find she was trending on Twitter, her feeds choked with thousands of furious replies and threats. When I asked her to describe the experience of becoming Twitter's main character for the day, she summed it up thusly: "You're repurposed as fodder for content generation in a way that's just so dehumanizing." 3 years later, these words resonate even stronger. What Hunt described to me then as a platform failure feels to me now like a learned behavior of the internet, where people, famous and not, are repurposed as fodder for content generation. The cycle repeats itself endlessly. This afternoon, the memes about Middleton shifted from jokes about her whereabouts to jokes about how awful it was that everyone had been making fun of a cancer patient. Feeling bad about the memes, tweets immediately became a meme unto themselves. Despite the tone shift, the reason for these posts is the same. They're a way to take a person and repurpose their life for entertainment and engagement. If this sounds exhausting and depressing, it's because it is. But the internet is also too big to be one thing. Clicking through social media this afternoon, I saw dozens of heartfelt testimonials, apologies, and well wishes for the princess. For the moment, from my perspective, it felt like watching a collective of people come to their senses. A recognition, perhaps, of the humanity of the person at the center of the maelstrom. Then, only a few seconds later, I saw a different post. It was a screenshot from the blockchain platform Solana, where users can create their own cryptographic tokens for others to invest in. The name of the token in the screenshot is Kate WIF Cancer, and its logo is still of the princess sitting on a bench, taken from this afternoon's video. The coin's market cap briefly surpassed $120,000. Only 6 minutes later, the price had cratered, the result of a standard meme coin sell-off. An awful thing happened. Some people made a joke about it. Other people made some money. And then everyone moved on. That's the end of the article. The author, Charlie Wazell, is a staff writer at The Atlantic and the author of its newsletter, Galaxy Brain, about technology, media, and big ideas. The name of his article was "We're All Just Fodder." I'm going to take a moment to remind you, particularly those who may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I'm reading are from the online edition of the Atlantic, and they're all published in March of 2024. This article is from the politics section. The title is "Why Trump Won't Stop Suing the Media and Losing." His lawsuits against the press are expensive and futile, and a lot more rational than they appear. By Paul Farhi. Why would the most notoriously cash-strapped man in America waste money on frivolous lawsuits? On Monday, Donald Trump, whose lawyers recently announced that he can't come up with the money to post a $454 million bond in his civil fraud case, fired off yet another suit against a news organization that reported facts he didn't like. The targets this time are ABC News and its anchor, George Stephanopoulos, who Trump alleges defamed him by stating that Trump had been found liable for raping E. Jean Carroll. The case looks like a sure loser. Trump was technically found liable under New York law for sexual abuse, not for rape, but the judge in the civil case ruled that, by forcibly penetrating Carroll's vagina with his fingers, Mr. Trump, in fact, did rape Ms. Carroll, as that term commonly is used and understood. But no matter. The Stephanopoulos suit slots into a well-worn groove for Trump, who for years has lodged periodic lawsuits against alleged purveyors of, quote, fake news about him. Targets have included the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, Bob Woodward, and a Wisconsin TV station that ran an attack ad against him during the 2020 campaign. Trump has even gone after the board of the Pulitzer Prizes for awarding Pulitzers to the Post and the Times for their coverage of his connections to Russia. Filing these suits has been costly for Trump, or rather for donors to his campaign and affiliated political action committees who have footed millions of dollars in legal fees. Not one of Trump's media lawsuits has ever succeeded, nor is one ever likely to, given both the underlying facts and the towering bar a president or former president faces in proving defamation. In one case against the New York Times, a judge found Trump's argument so flimsy that he ordered Trump to pay the Times legal fees. In other cases, such as the one involving the Wisconsin station, the suit was quietly withdrawn a few months after it was filed. So why does he keep doing it? On a basic level, this appears to be just Trump being Trump, peevish, headstrong, and narcissistic. For decades, his love-hate relationship with reporters has tended to flare into legal action, as it did in 2006 when he sued the writer Tim O'Brien over a few pages in a book that questioned Trump's personal wealth. As Trump told me in an interview in 2016, he knew he couldn't win that suit. He didn't, but brought it anyway to score a few points. I spent a couple of bucks on legal fees, and O'Brien's publisher spent a whole lot more, he said then. I did it to make his life miserable, which I am happy about. But Trump's quixotic legal crusades are not as irrational as they appear. Suing the press serves as a branding exercise and a fundraising tool. The lawsuits show his supporters that Trump is taking the fight to those lying journalists. So won't you contribute a few dollars to the cause? They thus have become an end unto themselves, part of an infinite loop. Sue, publicize the suit, solicit and collect donations, sue again. The cases may be weak on the legal merits, but they further his narrative of being persecuted by the radical left media. Brett Kappel, a campaign finance lawyer who has researched Trump's legal actions against the press, told me. This narrative has been a fixture of Trump's fundraising pitches for years. A few weeks after his inauguration in 2017, one of his fundraising committees sent out an email urging donors to do your part to fight back against the media's attacks and deceptions by sending contributions that would help cut through the noise of news reports. Even before Trump filed a lawsuit against CNN in August 2022 for describing his election lies as the big lie, his campaign was using the non-existent suit to drum up contributions. I'm calling on my best and most dedicated supporters to add their names to stand with me in my impending lawsuit, all caps, against fake news CNN, read a fundraising email. A second email sent out under Trump's name a few hours later struck a sterner note. "I'm going to look over the names of the first 45 patriots who added their names to publicly stand with their president against CNN. When Trump got around to filing the suit 2 months later, the appeals began anew. "I am suing the corrupt news network CNN for defaming and slandering, both in uppercase, my name," the campaign email read, in a chaotic typographical style reminiscent of a ransom note. "They've called me a liar, and so far I've been proven right about everything. Remember, when they come after me, they are really coming after you. I'm calling on you to rush in a donation of any amount right now to make a statement that you proudly stand with me." The suit was dismissed last year by a federal judge appointed by Trump. Trump is appealing. Of course, the cost of suing news organizations is a pittance compared with what Trump's donors are spending on his criminal defense. But it isn't cheap. According to Federal Election Commission records culled by Capel, the Trump-controlled Save America PAC shelled out nearly $500,000 to the firm that sued the Pulitzer Prize board on Trump's behalf in 2022. It paid $211,000 last year to another law firm that handled Trump's litigation against CNN, among other matters, and an additional $203,000 to the firm handling the appeal. The biggest recipient by far has been the attorney Charles Harder, the defamation specialist who represented Hulk Hogan in his successful suit against Gawker Media in 2016. From early 2018 to May 2021, according to FEC records, Harder took $4.4 million in fees from the Trump-affiliated organizations. At one point in 2020, Harder's Beverly Hills firm received more money than any other firm doing work for Trump. Harder's work on Trump's behalf didn't produce anything close to his career-making Hogan verdict, which resulted in a $140 million award that drove Gawker into bankruptcy. Harder took the lead in Trump's effort to suppress publication of Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, in 2018. He sent cease and desist letters to Wolff and his publisher, Henry Holt & Company, before the book's release, claiming that it contained libelous passages. The book was released as scheduled and became a bestseller, and Trump didn't sue. In 2020, Harder handled Trump's lawsuit against The Times, alleging that an opinion piece by the former Times editor Max Frankel was defamatory. A judge dismissed that suit in 2021. Harder, who no longer represents Trump, declined to comment for this story. Whether Trump's beat-the-press strategy is a net financial winner, once all the donations are collected and the attorney fees are subtracted, is hard to say. But Trump's filing of another hopeless lawsuit this week suggests that the math may be in his favor. Why bother paying lawyers millions of dollars to sue and appeal if the return on investment is less than zero? Trump may be petty and irrational, but he has never been accused of neglecting his own financial interests. A Trump spokesperson didn't return a request for comment. At the moment, of course, Trump has much bigger headaches. As of this writing, he's days away from having his assets seized to satisfy that civil fraud judgment. His overall fundraising has lagged President Joe Biden's, and he is burning through his supporters' money to pay for his criminal defense. Despite all that, he still finds a way to keep filing lawsuits against the media. You almost have to admire the commitment. That completes the article. The author, Paul Farhi, recently left The Washington Post, where he reported on the news media for 13 years. And the title of his article was "Why Trump Won't Stop Suing the Media and Losing." The title of our next article is Good Luck Fighting Disinformation. A group that formed during the pandemic to counter medical lies found that every lever it pulled on failed to produce the results it was hoping for. By Quinta Jurisic. In April 2022, Nick Sawyer sat down before a committee of the California State Assembly to argue for legislation to help limit the spread of COVID falsehoods. Sawyer, an emergency room physician, had become frustrated by what he saw as the failure of his profession to respond to doctors sharing false information about the pandemic. He'd co-funded an advocacy group, No License for Disinformation, or NLFD, and now he was testifying in favor of legislation that warned doctors of professional consequences for misleading patients about the coronavirus, prescribing ivermectin as a COVID cure, for example, or claiming that COVID vaccines would magnetize their blood. 5 months later, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed the bill into law. But for Sawyer and other proponents of the bill, known as AB 2098, the victory was short-lived. The legislation immediately became snarled in First Amendment challenges. Sawyer and his colleagues at NLFD, overwhelmed by harassment from COVID skeptics and frustrated by the sluggishness of medical authorities in responding to falsehoods, decided to close the organization's doors. And a year after AB 2098 became law, Newsom quietly signed another bill repealing it. The collapse of No License for Disinformation and of AB 2098 is a cautionary tale about why the harmful falsehoods flooding American life are so difficult to control, even when enormous efforts are made to do so. Sawyer and his colleagues believed that disinformation could be clearly identified and successfully countered, that the industry consensus would support them, that allies would line up behind them, that their professional organization had the power to tamp down those untruths. All of these assumptions proved wrong to varying degrees. The market for lies still has no shortage of buyers and sellers, and few, if any, levers exist that can directly change this dynamic. In the early months of the pandemic, when New York City's hospitals were breaking under the strain of patients sick with the new virus, medical workers from across the country arrived to volunteer in the city's healthcare system. Sawyer was one of them. Based in California, he traveled to Elmhurst Hospital Center in Queens, one of the hardest-hit facilities in a city devastated by COVID. At one point, he looked out of a window while treating a patient and saw two refrigerated trucks used to store bodies of the dead. The experience left Sawyer furious over the increasing spread of falsehoods about the virus, and as time went on, the life-saving vaccines as well. He and fellow California emergency physician Taylor Nichols saw patients who became seriously ill or died after having declined the vaccine. Some would demand to be treated with ivermectin or refuse to be tested for COVID because they believed the swab would infect them. Sawyer and Nichols were appalled to see reports of other healthcare workers around the country lending these ineffective treatments and conspiracy theories credibility. Most prominent among this group was the organization America's Frontline Doctors, which denounced pandemic restrictions and promoted debunked or unproven COVID cures. A video filmed by the group in July 2020, in which people wearing white coats stood arrayed on the steps of the Supreme Court while discouraging masking and advocating for the use of hydroxychloroquine, spread rapidly across social media when then-President Donald Trump promoted it on Twitter. As the pandemic went on, the group adopted baseless criticisms of the safety and effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines and reportedly began offering prescriptions of ivermectin, which studies have shown to be ineffective as a COVID treatment but remains popular among those opposed to the vaccine. As a small but influential number of doctors spread pandemic falsehoods, healthcare workers and advocates begin asking why authorities weren't doing more to stop them. On paper, many state laws provide medical boards with the authority to investigate doctors who deceive patients or the public about health concerns such as the coronavirus. These boards, which are public entities authorized by state governments, provide doctors with their licenses to practice medicine and have the power to suspend or remove that license. In July 2021, the Federation of State Medical Boards, FSMB, a nonprofit association of state medical regulators, got involved, announcing that physicians who generate and spread COVID-19 vaccine misinformation or disinformation are risking disciplinary action by state medical boards, including the suspension or revocation of their medical license. That risk wasn't new. Doctors who act in certain ways that could be harmful to patients have always faced potential discipline. Humayun Chaudhary, the FSMB's president and CEO, told me. But in the midst of concerns about pandemic falsehood, Chaudhary explained the Federation's statement was meant as a reminder. Sawyer contacted medical authorities at the FSMB and the California Medical Board to ask how they intended to put the Federation's suggestion into action. But, he said, nothing happened. We were waiting for somebody to step up to protect the institutions that were being attacked, Sawyer told me. And after a while, when that didn't happen, we decided to create No License for Disinformation. The FSMB denied that it had failed to respond to Sawyer's outreach. We appreciate his group's effort to bring attention to this issue of physician misinformation, Chaudhary said, of Sawyer's work, pointing to what he described as NLFD's productive conversations with FSMB, as well as with individual state medical boards. The California Medical Board declined to comment. In September 2021, Sawyer, Nichols, and a group of other doctors unveiled their new organization in a Washington Post op-ed. State medical boards must immediately act to revoke the medical licenses of doctors who use their professional status to deliberately mislead patients for reasons of politics or profit, they argued. No License for Disinformation would provide a website where members of the public could report doctors spreading lies to state medical boards, which could investigate them and potentially suspend or remove their licenses to practice medicine. The goal, Sawyer explained to me, was to try and actually get the medical boards to pay attention, putting pressure on them to take action against those physicians who were using their credentials to spread falsehoods. It's not hard to find mistruths circulating about the coronavirus online, but those spread by medical professionals carry a particular risk. Wearing a white coat can make even kooky statements seem more believable. The title of being a physician lends credibility to what people say to the general public, Chaudhary explained to the New York Times, following the FSMB's July 2021 statement. That's why it is so important that these doctors don't spread misinformation. I met Sawyer and Nichols in the summer of 2022 when I interviewed them for a podcast series about online falsehoods. By that point, No License for Disinformation had co-published a report with the De Beaumont Foundation, a public health nonprofit arguing for reforms to state medical boards' authorities and practices to better respond to the doctors whose lies, distortions, and baseless conspiracy theories have caused unnecessary suffering and death and are prolonging the pandemic. Some doctors had faced discipline for prescribing ivermectin or advising patients against wearing masks, but overall Sawyer and Nichols remained frustrated by what they saw as inexcusable inaction by state medical boards and other institutions. Fueled by this frustration, NLFD took a more aggressive strategy than many other groups working to counter pandemic falsehoods. Instead of focusing on promoting good information over bad, the organization sought to cut misperceptions off at the source. It ran an active, pugnacious Twitter account, accusing particular doctors of being responsible for spreading falsehoods and demanding that they be held accountable. It also backed AB 2098, the California legislation which clarified the California Medical Board's authority to investigate doctors who advise their patients on the basis of knowing lies or falsehoods, contradicted by contemporary scientific consensus. But what exactly does consensus mean? It's not always easy to identify precisely what's true and what's false, or to decide who should be responsible for making that determination. When I first interviewed Sawyer and Nichols, they took this critique seriously, but argued that their advocacy focused on claims that couldn't possibly be subject to reasoned debate, such as the notion that vaccines caused AIDS or injected patients with microchips. Having all these academic debates about disinformation takes away the strength of the word lie, Sawyer said when we spoke again in April 2023. Lies that are killing people. There are legal limits, though, to what state medical boards can do. As government entities, they're bound by the First Amendment, which restricts their ability to discipline physicians for constitutionally protected speech, especially for public advocacy that's separate from private conversations with patients in a doctor's office. The basis of the First Amendment concerns is the concern about chilling valuable speech. Carl Coleman, a law professor who studies medical regulation, explained to me, "You don't want to create an environment where doctors are afraid to question prevailing wisdom." In his view, medical boards can play a role in those really, truly egregious cases of flat-out lying. But it's a fine line. "This is the history of medicine playing out in real time," says Jim Downs, the author of Maladies of Empire, How Colonialism, Slavery, and War Transformed Medicine, who has written about the coronavirus pandemic for The Atlantic. "Public health crises," he told me, "commonly involve heated debates over how best to understand the science. And that debate is what pushes medicine forward." Though, Downs allowed, doctors who insist that vaccines will magnetize you or fill your blood with microchips are engaging in this conversation in a very extreme, potentially harmful way. The story of AB 2098 reflects the difficulty of distinguishing dangerous quackery from productive disagreement, all the while without running afoul of the First Amendment. The initial legislation introduced by Democratic Assembly member Evan Lowe in February 2022 would have allowed the state medical board to investigate doctors who shared misinformation or disinformation related to COVID-19, either publicly or with patients. But the bill provided scarce guidance as to exactly what misinformation or disinformation physicians were supposed to avoid, and its seeming prohibition on public remarks by doctors questioning the medical consensus raised serious problems under the First Amendment. Lawmakers later tightened the definition of misinformation or disinformation and narrowed the bill to focus only on medical advice provided to patients, leaving public-facing speech untouched. That put AB 2098 on firmer First Amendment footing, but meant that the legislation would do little to constrain the influence of doctors who promoted falsehoods in viral tweets. It also constrained the law's scope to the degree that by the time Newsom signed the bill in September 2022, it wasn't even clear whether AB 2098 would actually grant the state medical board any new powers in addition to its existing authority to investigate unprofessional conduct. Still, the No License for Disinformation team hoped that the legislation would push state authorities to take action. Through public vigilance, we can reinforce the Medical Board of California's commitment to its mission, Sawyer wrote in an op-ed defending the law against critics. NLFD's advocacy in favor of AB 2098 placed Sawyer, Nichols, and their colleagues under a new level of scrutiny. And in December 2021, they'd watched closely when Christina Lawson, then the president of California's medical board, announced on Twitter that she'd been followed and confronted by a group that peddles medical disinformation, which she said ambushed her in a parking garage. Press reports identified the group as America's Frontline Doctors. Several months later, America's Frontline Doctors released a video showing footage of Lawson being questioned in a parking garage by a physician investigator who described the incident as an interview conducted in a public place with witnesses. And with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time today. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry, and I've been reading the articles from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you've missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, and then click on Demand. Here you'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.